At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The story of Henry Ford and the assembly line and the automobile and the $5 day is American bedrock by now. But it's worth looking again at how one man and his tinkering and his very personal vision changed a culture, a country, the world. This hour, On Point, a new biography of Henry Ford makes it all new again. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Is it still the world he made? Are we on to another now? Whose? We'll look at that as well. Let's jump in the Wayback Machine for just a minute here. 1929, Henry Ford, the man himself, sitting around with tire magnate Harvey Firestone and inventor Thomas Edison, talking about opportunities for young men in new technologies in the then early 20th century. Here's a little 1929 radio chat bit archived by the Benson Ford Research Center.
If a young man makes up his mind to work, there's no limit to what he can do. If he makes up his mind to go at it without the idea of work, he hasn't much chance. He must study and work, and he must go back in any art as far as he can to dig up the very beginning, and he must, and the more he goes back, the further he will be able to see ahead.
The very voice there of Henry Ford in 1929, a little fuzzy, but it makes it very real. With us right now from Ann Arbor, New York, Ann Arbor, tell us, is Richard Snow, author of the big new biography, I Invented the Modern Age. We have an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. A man equally easy to admire or disdain, but impossible to dismiss, says Publishers Weekly, of Henry Ford. Richard Snow, welcome. I guess you're in Ann Arbor today.
I am in Ann Arbor today, and
I'm sorry we missed you last week, but thanks, thanks for being here.
Thank
right
you
now.
For your breadth of spirit and letting me have another chance.
No, I'm glad you're here. We joked about it being a broken down Model T, but I think it was just New York traffic and subways and all the rest. But
yeah,
we're glad you're here.
Apocalyptic even by Sixth Avenue standards.
Listen, there is so much to marvel at here, some things to just kind of shake our heads at. But take us back just to the engineering first. We think of the horse and buggy as being the predecessor of the automobile. But you take us back to Henry Ford and, of all things, bicycles. What's the engineering path here?
It's true. It's perfectly true that the automobile grew far more out of the bicycle than it did out of the horse or the railroad. There had been, in the decade before automobiles began to infiltrate the American consciousness, a real bicycle craze. And people still, of course, ride bicycles, but this was out of all proportion to what goes on today. It came up suddenly, lasted about 8 years, and then for reasons that remain unclear, sort of dwindled away. But during the time it was on, a great many advances had to be made to make a bicycle. You needed all sorts of new precision tools. You needed to have very fine tolerances. And so in a way, the nation was ready for the even finer tolerances that an automobile demanded.
So here's this mechanical genius, Henry Ford. He's born just weeks after the Battle of Gettysburg, takes us back.
Yes.
How does his personality, his mechanical genius, as you and many others describe it, intersect with this moment, with the bicycle craze, the technological moment, the machine tool moment?
He had been interested in making a machine that went by itself since he was a 13-year-old boy and saw a steam traction engine used to work on farms. They were usually hauled around by horses, but the owner of this one had chained the machine to itself, in effect, and it was rolling up the road all by itself, and he never got that out of his system. He was going to build an automobile from the time he was in his teens, and he was in Detroit, which was a very good place to learn it because there was standing timber to the north. There was lots of iron ore around. And Detroit itself, by the time he got there in the 1870s, was a real manufacturing city with 1,000 different machine shops. And these were his college, basically. And he had a tremendous, almost eerie feel for machinery. Right at the end of his life, he could look at 6 identical carburetors laid out on a bench and point to the one that wasn't working properly.
Wow.
This was in it. This was in his blood.
Who was Henry Ford, Richard Snow? Where did he come up from? Who was this
he
man?
He was a farm boy. He was he liked to sort of talk about how he'd had a hard time coming up, and in fact, his father was quite a prosperous farmer and really a leading citizen of Dearborn. Henry Ford had immense contradictions in his personality right from the beginning, and the beginning was his farm life. He loved everything about the farm except farming. All farm work is hard work, and he thought from the time he was about 5 that it was too hard and that he wanted to find ways to use machinery to shift burdens that people had to carry since biblical times. And 50 years later, when he was one of the half dozen most successful capitalists in history, he hated capitalism. So a very, very divided character here, but the time his formidable energies worked toward one end was when he was putting his first automobile together.
He could be a genius of creation. He turned out to be. He could also be extremely cranky. He could be a straight-up bigot. Later on, we'll look at that as well. It wasn't just mechanical genius, though. There was a kind of vision of how society ought to work that was embedded in Ford's view of the world that maybe is the reason that you quote him saying that he ultimately invented modernity, and it was about who ought to be able to afford and drive automobiles. He didn't go for the sort of standing notions of his day originally.
Well, that's entirely true, and it's – he often would exaggerate stories about himself, but in this case it seems clear that in building an automobile right from the beginning, he wanted to make one that could be put in the hands of basically every American. Now, in the first generations of cars, they were extremely complicated to make. They were the most complex machines that ever gone on the market, and makers naturally thought the best way to go was to make a car as expensive as it could be. In 1907, a Packard Gray Wolf cost $7,000 when a suburban house might cost $1,200.
So that might be, what, $1 million or something in current dollars? I have no idea, but it's a huge sum.
Yeah, and it made sense. Henry Ford looked at it exactly the other way. He said, no, everyone will do better and the country will do better if we make a car that farmers and shopkeepers can drive. And he did have a vision of it bringing the ancient isolation of the farm, breaking that, and bringing people together as a society. He was genuinely visionary in his early years, and those were certainly his best years.
He was an engineer for Thomas Edison, with the Edison Illuminating Company. You write about a 50th anniversary celebration of the creation of the electric light bulb that Ford was at, and the famous comedian Will Rogers was there. And at one point in the festivities, Will Rogers points to Henry Ford and says, without a trace of his occasional folksiness, you write, Richard, Will Rogers says, it will take 100 years to tell whether you, Henry Ford, have helped us or hurt us, but you certainly didn't leave us where you found us. That in 1929, what was the ambiguity, ambivalence that Will Rogers was pointing to?
Well, already by 1929, the automobile had shown itself to be a wonderful social elixir, but a very violent one. We already had highway congestion. You had what some people saw as an absolute breakdown of the family. It allowed on the personal level of a great deal more sexual experimentation.
People gadding about in automobiles. People
gadding about in automobiles and parking in automobiles. Yeah. This had an enormous impact on the social arrangements of the time. I mean, prior to that, you were – if you wanted to do courting, you were pretty much stuck on the front porch of your possibly future in-law's house. When he gave mobility to everybody, he gave mobility to everybody, and it broke down many societal boundaries and alarmed a lot of people. John Steinbeck said with sort of sardonic amusement, the Anglo-Saxon home has never recovered.
From the automobile. Was it moral yes. standards that Will Rogers would be primarily talking about there, or was it all the
no,
rest, the assembly
I think,
line
I think
work?
Rog- and I think the whole shooting match, the way it had changed industry, the way it the enormous wealth it generated, which of course could be deployed toward good ends or coarse and evil ones. It had really upset society more than any force I can think of in the 20th century.
And to maybe frame that century for millions and millions of Americans, maybe for all Americans, we're talking this hour about the world-changing impact of one man and his vision, his mechanical genius, and more, Henry Ford. He built enormous factories that turned out enormous numbers of first Model Ts. Engineers created the assembly line to keep up with demand. Here's a little bit of a tape of Jack Perkins narrating the 1994 A&E documentary, Henry Ford, Tin Lizzie Tycoon, explaining how it all worked.
The moving assembly line. August 1913, a chassis was put in motion at Ford's Highland Park plant. It moved past a line of carefully positioned men and components. At peak efficiency, the old system had spit out a finished T in 12 and a half man hours. With the chassis in motion, that time dropped to less than half that. Within a year, it took just 93 minutes to make a car.
And Ford celebrated that car. Here's archival footage from the Ford film collection, the company's promotional documentary, Henry Ford's Mirror of America, showing life in the 1910s with the Model T.
Mighty smooth riding now. There's one car that takes you anywhere you want to go. The Model T. Strong, sturdy, with a will of its own.
What was it like to work in those factories? Here's African-American factory worker David Moore. He was an employee at Ford from 1935 until 1972. He shared his thoughts about working conditions there in the A&E documentary.
How was my working life at Ford? I've never been to hell, but heard a lot about it. It was like working in hell. The harassment, the threats, the working conditions, and the continued watching over you by what they had called at that time a star man.
David Moore, who worked in the Ford factory from 1932. Richard Snow is with us. His biography is I Invented the Modern Age. What was it like to work on the floor of the Ford factory, Richard? I mean, there's firsthand testimony. It doesn't sound too great.
That was a fascinating quote. That's certainly what it was like then in 1935. Ford, it's eerie reading about Ford because for the first half of his life, he was a genuinely great man, I think. Kind, far-seeing, full of charitable impulses. The second half of his life, he was quite a terrible one. That reflected itself in the factory. In 20 years earlier, Ford factory would have been one of the best places to work in industry. It was a great big – the great big Highland Park plant had tall windows, glass everywhere. People called it the glass palace. People mm-hmm. There worked drenched in light. When you heard the worker talking in 1935, that had all changed. The company was run, but basically the shop floor was run by thugs. Ford was more and more cruel and arbitrary, both with his workforce and really with his very high lieutenants. He would fire people who had been with him from the very start and sometimes not even tell them they'd been fired, just have their desks removed in the middle of the night.
That's pretty tough behavior. Tough with his family as well. I want to look at that Edsel story. Richard Snow, stand by. We have callers coming in from all over. Los Angeles, California. Sri Ram is calling. Sri Ram, you're on the air with Richard Snow.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask about his relationship with his son, Edsel. I heard that he didn't let Edsel take over the company because Edsel did not agree with his practice of hiring ruffians to beat up the workers if they agitated for better wages. Is that true that he denied Edsel a position because he didn't agree with his business policies?
Sriram, thanks for your call. Richard Snow?
That's completely true. He put Edsel in charge very early and then gave him no authority whatever. He always thought Edsel was too weak. It's a great tragedy. It's embarrassing to call something Shakespearean, but there is a vibration of that in that Edsel was a great car man and the right man to run the second generation of automobiles. Henry Ford had made the car, the universal car, a possibility. But his was a utilitarian object. And within 10 years, people were beginning to see the car as an object of desire as well. Edsel understood that. Ford pretended to let him have his way and then checked him at every turn. He was jealous of him, but also I do think the great driving thing in Ford's becoming as sour as he did was his love of the Model T. I don't know an inventor who was more emotionally tied to his invention. He saw his car as more than transportation and more than a great money generator. He saw it as a moral force. And Edsel and everyone else who worked for him said, beginning in the mid-20s, listen, it's time to change. It's time to change. They're going to overtake us. And that made Ford increasingly furious.
We've got a little tape here of father and son, first Edsel and then Henry Ford. This was, again, from the A&E documentary back in 94, when they had been through the Great Depression and they were sort of talking up the country emerging from the Great Depression. Here's Edsel Ford and then father Henry.
They've been asking us what we think of the coming year. All I can say is that we feel pretty good about the outlook. The United States, even when it is running in low, is a pretty big business proposition. But I believe the country is getting ready to make a very decided step forward next year, and we are doing all that we can to help it along. What do you think of that, Father?
Well, I think everybody's decided that they've got to go to work. I think from now on, there's no one can stop this great country from going ahead.
Henry Ford right there alongside his son, Edsel. What did Henry Ford mean when he said, I invented the modern age? What did he mean by that to his mind, Richard?
Well, he was talking to a schoolboy who was interviewing him for a local paper. He was in his 70s then, and he got sentimental about the one-room schoolhouse and square dancing and stuff, and the kid thought this was very, very stodgy and said, well, Mr. Ford, that's all very well, but this is the modern age. And Ford said, young man, don't tell me about the modern age. I invented the modern age. And you notice he didn't say I made a hell of a lot of automobiles. He said he had made basically the world that he and the boy were living in. He saw the changes that he had wrought, and again with that fissure in his personality, he was immensely proud of what he saw as its socializing the instincts of the universal automobile and an automobile, a mobile society that had grown up around it. But also another part of him was very skeptical and alarmed about it, and always wistful about the simple life of the farm, although as I've said, he
didn't
want
to do the work.
There. He detested everything about the life.
We get that. So when he said, "I invented the modern world," he's thinking about the freedom, the mobility of the automobile, the technology
yes.
and industry model that he laid out. Middle class life, was that part of it?
I think yes, and the wealth that generated when he gave his workers that $5 day, that basically doubling the base salary of any industrial job. He made them his own customers. Nobody who was putting the Packard together could afford to buy it. Any Ford employee could afford to buy a Ford. And this started the cycle of consumerism. It spread to other industries, and it immensely broadened the middle class and set the nation on a kind of prosperity that held for generations.
A lot of people in his industrialist class were upset by that $5 day. As you say, it doubled the standard wage. People thought he was nuts and that he was upsetting the social order. I guess he was.
Oh yes. The Wall Street Journal said this sort of meant the end of America as we know it. And they all said, "Oh, damn it! This we're going to have to match this basically." And it did spread. And it also had a sort of tremendous moral impact. You were raising people to the middle class, and Ford was very much aware of this. He had something called the sociological department, where in order to qualify for the middle for that wage, you had to show that you were provident and putting money aside. He was very much interfered with his workers' lives.
Kind of morals police that he sicked onto his workforce.
Basically, yes, they were. Most of the workers felt a few nosy questions were worth getting the best job in industry. Others were openly defiant. One man, his investigators were questioning. They asked him if he'd put aside any money, and he said yes, he'd invested in houses and lots. And the investigator was very skeptical about this and said, "What do you mean? What do you mean?" He said, "I mean whorehouses and lots of whiskey."
Wouldn't make the cut.
Some were defiant, but yeah. Most took it. And indeed, it does seem in a way to have done more harm than good. The average Ford worker's savings when he put it in was $217, and when by the time the department began to wither, the average savings was over $2,000. And I know the great reformer Ida Tarbell went out there to attack Ford the way she had Standard Oil, and after a few weeks there said, "Look, this is good. He's doing the right thing. He's doing a very, very, very good thing. Any of the excesses will take care of themselves."
Well,
alas, that's not what happened.
Yeah, history can judge that. Let me get Bob here from Plainfield, Vermont.
Sure.
Bob, thanks for calling. You're on there with Richard Snow.
Hi, thank you. I appreciate the conversation and the nuances and complexity you're discussing. I'm a historian who's been particularly interested in the status of workers with disabilities. And in my own research on looking at the Ford archives, I found a number of instances where workers were profoundly disabled. They'd lose an arm, they'd lose a leg, two arms, both legs on the assembly line, which speaks to the, if you will, the violence of the assembly line and the difficulties of it on the one hand. And then on the other hand, Ford made a real commitment to then attempt to hire these workers with disabilities and to give them jobs that they could perform with one arm or with one leg. I remember going through files and seeing that they would classify jobs according to the ability to do it with a left arm or the ability to do it with a right arm. So I just wanted to add that in, that on the one hand, he was the first significant employer to hire people with disabilities, but at the same time, the very process that he created had been the one that had injured these workers.
That's a great note. Yes.
That's very nicely
Thank
put.
You,
that's absolutely true. And it's also absolutely true that Ford, more than any industrialist I know of that time, did, as you say, make real efforts to find work for disabled employees.
Also African-Americans he would hire.
Yes, that's interesting. When you think of the awful anti-Semitism stuff he got into, you would think this might reflect the general pattern of racism across the board. It didn't. Workers coming north would-be workers coming north in the great black migration of the post-World War I years knew that there was a chance you could get a job at Packard, and there was a much better chance that you could get one at Ford. And he, in fact, put black guys over white guys on work gangs with the power to fire them. And I think that was unique in industry at that time.
When did Henry Ford's anti-Semitism emerge, and how do you trace the origins of it? And describe just how big it got.
He'd gotten into some improvident law. He was used to getting wonderful press. He'd done a number of things that were genuinely good and deserved good press. And then for various reasons, he got involved in improvident lawsuits and stuff. The press turned against him, and he began to get bitter. I also think – I think it's no coincidence that this comes out at just about the time people were beginning to really push for him to change the Model T. But
– which he loved and never wanted to change and didn't care about style.
Never.
Yeah.
And he had bought this – NASA, you know, a little innocuous local paper called the Dearborn Independent, and turned it into – for 95 consecutive issues, he put out a series called The International Jew. Now, for – you know, for every big complicated problem, there's one simple solution, and it's always wrong. Ford had decided that that the great problems, war, the misuse of capitalism, monopoly, all were in the hands of an international conspiracy of Jews. Where this came from is very hard to say. He had a trusted secretary named Liebold who was of German extraction and proudly anti-Semitic. I mean, Ford at that time would leap to hunches. This might have just been some flea Liebold put in his ear, but –
He put a lot of it in there, and it was so fevered. The Nazis were reading it and applauding it in Germany.
Oh, hell yes, yes. He had known, he recirculated the protocols of the Elders of Zion, which was a czarist hoax put together showing that a consortium of high rabbis were ruling the world. He was incredibly – Ford was incredibly opaque about this. He had a very close friend in Rabbi Franklin, who was the chief rabbi of the Reformed Synagogue in Detroit, and so close that he would send him a new Model T every year. And when the Dearborn Independent started making its noise, the rabbi returned the car. Ford was baffled and horrified. He called him up. "What's the matter, Rabbi? Have I done something to offend you?"
Just 90 issues of rabid anti-Semitism in his newspaper.
Yeah, yeah. No, he thought what he saw as good Jews would be grateful for these pointers on how to behave.
Richard Snow writes the incredible story of Henry Ford in his new biography, I Invented the Modern Age, The Rise of Henry Ford. When we come back, we're going to look at the model of social and industrial change and who might be the Henry Ford of our time. Richard Snow, stand by in Ann Arbor, Michigan. It's great to have you here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the world-changing impact of one man and his vision, Henry Ford. We're going to hear in just a moment from Bill Wasik at Wired Magazine. Lots of feedback to you here, Richard. Satwa, not so crazy about Henry Ford, or Tom in Vermont, I guess this is. He says, Henry Ford created the traffic jam from which we can now tweet or call into On Point. Henry Ford created an assembly line to make cheap goods that, yeah, you know, pluses and minuses there. This listener says the real invention of the modern era is the train half a century earlier. Look at Europe. You can pretty easily get on a train from almost anywhere. America has been given a rum deal in the Henry Ford legacy. What do you say, Richard?
Well, I am so pickled in that legacy. I grew up in the the great post-war years, and I'm afraid it's just too much too much in my system. To
hit the road. Open up that big
V8. Automobile is my birthright.
Right.
And the road, the open road, yeah.
Let's go to Scotland.
Yeah, and I do think it's an immense socializing power. I understand all the drawbacks, of course. I live in Manhattan, but I do think in the main it's been a force more for good than for ill.
Will Rogers may have the last word on that even now. Maybe 100
right,
years before
right.
we know. Some would say we know now. I think Tom in Vermont may. Scott in Richmond,
Tom
Vermont.
Scott, God knows. Yeah. There's a case to be made.
Scott, you're on the air.
Henry Ford beat even the train. I've got an archive project I'm working on called FordTriMotor.org, and I am collecting information stories about the airplane
yes.
that Ford built. And not only did he build this airplane, the first all-metal airplane in the United States, but he defined commercial aviation as we know it. TWA, American Airlines, Pan Am, all of them got their start. And he also built the very first airport terminal and said, here, everybody, this is what it looks like. And he took his fleet of trimotors, which he only built 199 of them, but he took them out there, landed them in cordon fields, gave people $5 rides for 5 minutes, you know, 1929, that was a huge amount of money, electrified everybody to the potential of commercial aviation. And it's always just a footnote in Henry Ford's, you know, discussion and stuff. But I'm compelled to throw that into the mix.
Scott, I'm glad
right
you did.
Too.
Richard, yes.
One of the frustrating things about writing about Henry Ford is he did so damn much. And yeah, I don't mention the airplane in my book, but of course that was a tremendous innovative thing he did. And those Ford Trimotors were awfully good planes. They were, you know, they were still carrying passengers in the 1960s.
You do talk about World War II production and how
yes.
a lot of the industrial boundaries that Ford pushed and broke open may have been the key to Allied American victory in that conflict.
Well, yes, that's true. There's a saying that Britain gave us the time to win the war and Russia the blood and America the tools. And if that's the case, it was Henry Ford that gave us the tools. He was an ardent and sincere pacifist. He didn't want to take any part in World War II. In fact, for the first few months, he thought it was a newspaper hoax. But it was his production lines under his immensely capable lieutenant, Charles Sorensen, that actually set up basically a car production line building heavy bombers in Willow Run. And in fact, all the war material we made was made according to Fordian principles, and it made a tremendous difference, perhaps a decisive one.
Big irony, Henry Ford, the enormous anti-war figure. Catherine in Piermont, New Hampshire. Catherine, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Tom. I have a story from an old friend from Michigan in the early days of the century. They lived on a farm, and her father could see that cars were going to be the new thing in the country. So he sold the farm and moved into Dearborn and set up a dealership, which had space for about one or two cars, as they used to.
Okay.
So he would get on the train and go to Detroit with a can of gas and with a toolkit. There were no gas stations to help you out.
BYOG, bring your own gasoline, okay?
Right.
Yeah.
And he would buy one car from Ford and bring it back and sell it. And then when he had sold that, he'd get on the train again and go back and get another one.
Incredible.
And finally,
that's just how it worked.
Buddy with him too, so they could bring back two. And that's where it built up from. But here you are. It's a story of early Michigan.
That's a wonderful story, Catherine. I appreciate your call so much. One by one, Richard.
Yeah, absolutely. Early on, the branch managers would let the sub agents you don't get a new car till you you don't get a new model till you sell the last one. So there was a lot of grumbling and shuffling back and forth. They basically had two cars. They always had to have. Ford was very smart about setting up agencies. He did it early and he did it better than anybody. And there were strict rules. You always had to have one car in good shape in the agency, and then you would get one more car that you would sell, and then get another one. And you had to stock one of every part, and if ever a car broke down, you had to tow it only after dark, so people wouldn't notice.
That's pretty great, Catherine. Thank you for the story. Oklahoma City. We're thinking about Oklahoma today with the big tornado there. But Jeff is calling in. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I just wanted to ask a couple questions here, both pertaining to does the end justify the mean? Obviously, cars contribute a lot to our current global warming crisis that have going on right now, and especially in the wake of the severe storms we've had here yesterday and the day before. And two, does his prominent anti-Semitism and the awards he won from Nazi Germany, basically just his, all the things he contributed, does that, do you think that that justifies the end, justifies the means in relation to that?
Jeff will do it. Richard Snow put him in the balance. Here we've got CO2 and maybe a collapsing climate. We've got the legacy of Hitler's Germany.
Yes, I think the anti-Semitism. It's very, very hard to read about, and extremely unpleasant. And there was a lot of it, but. It, unlike the Model T, did not spark – there weren't 400 imitators of the Dearborn Independent. There was plenty of anti-Semitism in America, but
there were plenty in Germany at the time.
And in Germany, yes. Yeah. But that would have happened without Henry Ford's help. And it's sort of interesting. I do think the Ford Motor Company should get credit from the moment Ford died in 1947 and Henry II took over. They have steadily – work in very, sometimes subtle, always quite effective ways to try and erase this legacy. They helped Israel very early on by shipping trucks over. They've never pretended this didn't happen.
Jeff, it may be more than any mere mortal can do to put the scales to that balance of Henry Ford's legacy and the good and the ill of it. I mean, the story is still not fully written with the climate hanging over us and hanging over Oklahoma in the last couple of days here. Richard Snow, stand by. I want to bring the story up to date for a minute with Bill Wasik. He joins us right now from San Francisco. Senior editor at Wired Magazine. Big feature he's got in the brand new June issue. It's on newsstands today. It's about the future of technology. It's called In the Programmable World, All Our Objects Will Act as One. You can link to the article at our website, onpointradio.org. Bill Wasik, thanks very much for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Tom.
So here we're talking about Henry Ford and how, at least in his own mind's eye, he created the modern age, and he could make the case for it. One could make the case for it. People looking around and wondering who, in economic terms, industrial terms, technical terms, maybe social terms, if we have an equivalent person out there today, an equivalent company or movement out there today. Do you have it in Silicon Valley in your backyard, Wired, Bill? Are we remaking the Henry Ford's world right now? Is it up to that scale?
Well, we've got a lot of would-be Henry Fords out here. I think we're at an interesting hinge point. I would say in answering that question, and I think you can look, ironically, you can look at the automobile, and specifically, you can look at two different projects in the automotive space. One being the self-driving car, which is being spearheaded by Google, and the other one being in Tesla, which is this very innovative electric car manufacturer that's headed up by Elon Musk, also here in Silicon Valley. And what I think is fascinating about those two projects is that they sort of represent these two different ways of thinking about the future of technology, and they're not at all in competition. But with Google, you have it's essentially the end point of the car as a computer. Our cars have become more and more computerized, and essentially the insight with the self-driving car is, if the car is totally computerized and it's networked, then You can, you know, put way more cars on the road and avoid traffic jams. You can avoid accidents. You can completely revolutionize the way that we travel. And will it succeed? It's really way too early to tell. But you know, I would say it's symbolic of the way that Google, and you know, certainly you could nominate Larry Page and Sergey Brin of Google as potentially our next Henry Fords, right? And that they're sort of taking the information revolution and they are applying it to the ultimate in, you know, old-fashioned industrial product, which is the car. And then on the other side, you have Elon Musk, who really is this sort of old-fashioned, you know, make raw materials of the world bend to his will. I mean, there's a lot of computerization that helps Tesla do what it does. But at the end of the day, I mean, you know, Tesla is basically trying to rethink from the ground up the way that cars are made. It's a lot about materials. It's a lot about processes and efficiency, a lot of the same stuff that Henry Ford revolutionized but sort of brought into the 21st century. And again, it's sort of too early to know whether that's going to succeed. But, you know, he's trying to do the same thing with rockets and private space flight. You know, and if he succeeds, I think you can imagine a lot of people trying to follow in his footsteps and essentially say, no, it's not too late. You know, it's not, you know, in the 21st century, we can reinvent the way that we make physical products. And so it's a very interesting time. I don't think that we know who the next Henry Ford will be, but I think that we are going to learn in the next 10 years about some really big fundamental projects that will change the course of history.
You know, we're talking on an epic scale here when you compare it to Ford and everything that ensued from his inventions and his innovations in manufacturing and all the rest, Bill. When you put it up against that, what about the critique of people like the PayPal founder Peter Thiel, who's saying, you know what, we are not making breakthroughs of that stupendous quality that we need to change life as we know it these days? What about that critique, Bill?
Well, look, I think that critique is really correct on a fundamental level, and you know, I think that it is. We like to talk in Silicon Valley, but not just us in Silicon Valley, but everybody likes to, you know, look at the smartphones in our pockets and think about the internet and say, oh my gosh, the world has changed so much in the last, you know, 50 years. But man, I mean, you look at 50-year windows sort of any time from the beginning of the Industrial Revolution until around, you know, the 1920s and 1930s. And I mean, the level of societal transformation was way more, you know, disruptive and way more intense. You know, and on some level, I think the defense, it's sort of getting back to the you know, what Elon Musk is trying to do with Tesla. I mean, the defense against that was, you know, we had potentially pushed industrial processes as far as they could go, and now we're dealing with climate change, which is this problem. You know, it's essentially the problem that a lot of that innovation has led up to, and now that we're aware. I mean, you know, if we weren't worried about emissions, there's all sorts of stuff that we could do. Well, of course, we have the issue of energy prices. But the point just being that I think on some level, Peter Thiel's question, which is, can we get beyond just things that are happening on screens to really come up with transformational inventions, winds up being equivalent to the question of, you know, have we reached a dead end in terms of what we can do with manufacturing and with you know, engines, sort of all these fundamental things about life. Like, have we reached an endpoint of what we can do without killing the planet more than we already have? And I think that in a lot of areas we are trying to answer that question, and it'll be sort of the, you know, a lot is riding on what the answer to it is.
No kidding. Richard Snow, we've just got a minute here. When you look out across the landscape in more recent years, I don't know, Steve Jobs, Elon Musk, the Google guys, you name it, do you see a counterpart in terms of impact, in terms of era-creating stature to Henry Ford among us now?
In a way, although I am the last person to have a sensible thought on this, I didn't believe Amazon would ever amount to anything. But it does make me think, you know, you never know what seed is going to grow. And Ford said a very interesting thing in passing when he was talking about the car. He said there was no demand for the automobile. There never is for a new product. And that's a nice inversion of the old bromide about necessity being the mother of invention.
Yeah.
So often it's invention that summons up the necessity. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why the future, at least to me, is so clouded and elusive.
And so we wonder if we've got it in the works in front of us right now, if we're sitting in the beginnings of change on Ford's scale, or whether Peter Thiel's got it right and we're not at that kind of big break point, big advance point. I don't think we're going to solve that one today, but I must say I really enjoyed walking again into the Henry Ford story. It's a wonderful book you've written, Richard Snow. I Invented the Modern Age, The Rise of Henry Ford. Thank you for joining us from Ann Arbor today, Richard.
Thanks so much, Tom.
And thank Bill Wasik at Wired Magazine, senior editor there. I hope you'll come again. The big new piece in the current issue, the June issue, is In the Programmable World, All Our Objects Will Act as One. Maybe there's a piece of the breakthrough. Bill, come back. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow in this hour, we will talk about re-engineering Tornado Alley after the Oklahoma storm, re-engineering for the age of superstorms. Join us for that. Thanks for being with us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.